There were people working for incarcerated people with HIV. There were people working with mothers who were HIV positive.
Tune to Out FM from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday, September 14th for a two-hour fundraising special on the history of the direct action AIDS group, ACT UP, on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Stay tuned for the Independent News Hour. It's 5 p.m., and this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online.
Welcome to the Independent News Hour. In the headlines today, California voters decide whether to replace their current governor with a right-wing talk show host. A flood-prone Staten Island community fights for its wetlands. And state officials denounce the humanitarian crisis at Rikers Island. Good evening. In New York, I'm John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of the Independent, New York City's progressive newspaper and website. In California, voters head to the polls today in the final day of voting over whether to recall Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom. Newsom's most prominent challenger is a right-wing talk show host, Larry Elder, who has vowed to eliminate mask and vaccine mandates in California. This is President Joe Biden speaking at a rally yesterday urging voters to vote no on Newsom's recall.
The reason I'm here, and you all are here, is to thank and support our friend, Governor Gavin Newsom, the best governors in the country. California, I'm not sure you know it, but if you didn't know it, you should. The eyes of the nation, this is not hyperbole, the eyes of the nation are on California, because the decision you're about to make, isn't this going to have a huge impact on California? It's going to reverberate around the nation, and quite frankly, not a joke, around the world.
One out of eight people in the United States live in California, which would be the world's fifth largest economy if it were its own nation. In Texas, Hurricane Nicholas came ashore last night as a Category 1 storm and is expected to dump as much as a foot of rain in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama in the next couple of days, which could cause heavy flooding. Here in New York, the de Blasio administration says the 46-acre East River Park must be demolished to build an 8 to 10-foot flood barrier to prevent future storms from swamping the Lower East Side. Local residents say cutting down nearly 1,000 mature trees is ecocide. Yesterday, nervous park defenders sprang into action at the site of what appeared to be the first fresh tree stump in the park. This is Eileen Miles of East River Park Action.
Well, yesterday, one of our members spotted a tree stump down at the northern end of the park, which looked like a fresh cut tree. You know, and there was an assembly of trucks there and construction. We took this to mean that this is the beginning of the city's assault on the park and the beginning of cutting down 991 trees. So what we used it as an alarm. We started to gather there at noon, and we stayed there till the mid-afternoon. It started to be clear that the tree, in fact, had not been cut in the morning.
Yesterday on Staten Island, a group of residents who have been fighting to save the Graniteville wetlands from a massive development rallied at Borough Hall and marched to the offices of Council Member Debbie Rose and State Senator Diane Savino. The site of the development, which is to include a giant BJ's wholesale club, a gas station, and an 835-car parking lot and other buildings, is located in the diverse, predominantly working-class northwestern tip of Staten Island. Construction work began in early July, and residents say that the extreme flooding they experienced 2 months later when Hurricane Ida passed through is a direct result of the loss of over 1,400 mature trees that were cut down over the summer. This is a local resident speaking at yesterday's rally.
We've been warning many people, including Council Member Debbie Rose. We have been warning them for 4 years that if we lose the wetland, we will be flooded. They started cutting down the trees in July, beginning of July, and compacting the land. On September 1st, we were flooded, less than 2 months later. That's why we told you so. People were putting their belongings out on the street. Their
There is at least one house on South Avenue that was flooded. I saw them pumping the water out of their home.
And finally, a delegation of 11 elected officials visited Rikers Island yesterday morning. They reported current conditions on Rikers are more dangerous than ever, constituting a humanitarian crisis. The jails there are overcrowded with a population that has surged to more than 6,000 people above pre-pandemic levels. The refusal of thousands of correction officers to show up to work has left incarcerated people without adequate food, medical attention, or access to other basic services that the city is legally and ethically required to provide. These violations are manifesting in a wave of violence and death on Rikers. 9 people have died in Department of Corrections custody this year and 3 on Rikers in the past month. This is Congressman Jamal Bowman, who was one of the visiting elected officials, speaking after the visit.
We need new facilities, we need a new mindset, and we need to take a mental health approach and a behavioral health approach. There are many people in there who are there because of technical parole violations and other technicalities that should not be in there, and they need to be decarcerated as quickly as possible.
We'll be back with our first guest after this short break.
Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me dio 2 luceros que cuando los abro perfecto distingo lo negro del blanco. Y en el alto cielo su fondo estrellado, en las multitudes el hombre que yo amo. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me ha dado el oído.
That was Gracias a la Vida, performed by Chilean folk singer Violeta Parra. In New York, I'm John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent, New York City's progressive newspaper and website. You can find us on independent.org. That's independent.org. It's great to be with you here today on WBAI Radio, and I'm joined by my colleague, Amba Gagarian.
Hi, John, and hello to all our listeners on WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming on WBAI.org. Happy to be here with you today.
Yes, and for our first segment today, we're going to talk about Occupy Wall Street. Its 10th anniversary is coming up later this week. It was 10 years ago this week that people started an encampment at Zuccotti Park down in Lower Manhattan, just up the street from Wall Street. And were there for almost 2 months and made a huge impact on the city and on this country and how we see economic inequality, the 1%, the 99%, and so much more. Our first guest should be joining us shortly. While we wait for Priscilla Grimm to join us, Amba, I was just going to point out, we have a new issue of The Independent. New issue of The Independent that will hit the streets later this week. And a big part of what we focus on there as well is the 10th anniversary of Occupy. It's such a huge impact it had, especially on the left in the United States. It's really hard to overstate how demoralized and lifeless the left was in 2011
before Occupy hit. A lot of people were waiting for Barack Obama to do something magical and awesome. And that just was not going to happen. It was pretty clear by year three of his administration. And a lot of people knew what the problems were. I mean, Wall Street had just ripped off the country for hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, in a bailout for their bad behavior. And there was no accountability. No one went to jail for all the crimes they committed. And it finally, it took these mostly young people putting their, you know, sleeping bags or in some cases, just their cardboard boxes on the pavement at Zuccotti Park and saying, you know, this is unacceptable. We are the 99%. We're tired of getting ripped off by the 1%. And then, you know, that battle cry resonated with so many people who recognized the truth in it. I'm curious how you look back on it.
Well, I was just going to say it's interesting because I think generally we remember Occupy Wall Street, the occupation of Wall Street in New York City, but the ripple effect was really amazing. I mean, I was 15 living in North Carolina, and that was certainly the first time that, I don't know, I think probably even capitalism was brought to my attention. But I remember people camping out for weeks at the City Hall in Asheville, North Carolina, and at city halls all around the country. That's something that really sticks with me. It was a radicalizing moment for sure. I was like, why are they out there? You know, but I'm curious about an anecdote or memory you have from, you know, the big encampment here, which was definitely far more interesting.
Yeah, the energy there, you know, it was 24/7. And, you know, people were out in the streets protesting every day. And actually twice a day, they would go down to this New York Stock Exchange for both the opening and the closing of the Stock Exchange and be down there, you know, chanting all day, all night, all week, Occupy Wall Street. But what really made Occupy take off in a way, it might not have happened the same way without a big assist from the New York Police Department. It was there. Hello? Yeah.
Hello.
So it was their sort of random brutality that really helped draw attention and public sympathy to Occupy in its early weeks, when a lot of people weren't really yet focused on it. And in particular, there were two incidents, one involving a deputy inspector who had almost 30 years on the force named Anthony Baloney, a.k.a. Tony Baloney, who came up to these two young women who were trapped behind the orange net at the end of a protest. And he just pulled out his pepper spray and blasted them in the face. And they were, you know, screaming in pain. And this was all captured on cell phone video and quickly went viral on, you know, Facebook and Twitter. And then the conventional media picked it up. We saw a situation where, you know, the tears of these two young women were, you know, far more powerful than the brute force of the NYPD, and they had some explaining to do, and it brought a lot of sympathy. And of course, a week later, there was the mass arrest of 700 people on the Brooklyn Bridge. And again, it really just sort of focused people like, what's going on here? Why is this happening? And it created a huge opening where the media started to pay more attention, and then their message was resonating. And then here in New York, the labor unions got behind Occupy in a big way. They saw that Occupy was breaking through on these issues of economic inequality in a way that all their sort of more cautious conventional messaging had failed for years. And they saw that, again, these kids camped out in a park were breaking through with this, you know, discourse about the 1% and 99%. So they got it behind it in a big way. You had demonstrations with as many as 30,000 people, and many of them were, labor unionists, and then also the labor unions, you know, provided storage space for supplies, they extra meeting space, you know, when the park became completely overrun with people. And so the unions helped out in a big way. And it was a great alliance to see, again, you know, two groups that kind of come from sort of culturally different spheres, the sort of the more sort of countercultural vibe around Occupy, and then these labor unions, which are big institutions here in New York, and they made a common cause, and it was a really powerful partnership. And it also gave Occupy not only like a certain mainstream credibility here in New York, but it was another thing that put our billionaire mayor, Michael Bloomberg, on his back foot, because it's one thing to say to try to crack down on a bunch of kids in a park. It's another thing when you have these massive labor unions. We're having a little bit of a live radio moment here, but I think I got my microphone back together. We're still waiting for Priscilla Grimm from Occupy Wall Street to join us, hopefully any moment now. But yeah, it's interesting to think back about what happened. And, I think one thing that had the NYPD, they had pretty effortlessly repressed protests for years before Occupy. During the Bloomberg era, during the Iraq War protests, the Republican National Convention in 2004, other things like the critical mass bike rides, but they were not prepared for some of the changes in technology that had occurred in the years before 2011 with the development of social media, the development of live streaming, all these media tools that gave Occupy the ability to directly reach millions of people who could tune into what was happening, first at Zuccotti Park, and then all these other encampments around the country. And there were, I think, Occupy encampments in more than 600 cities and towns. And
well, studying some of the NYPD's tactics used at Occupy, and then also seeing photos, looking over photos for this upcoming issue that we just mentioned of the NYPD on the Brooklyn Bridge attacking protesters, obviously brought back memories from last summer. And based on my studies and experience, there was hardly any change, if not just amping up between their responses to what happened 10 years ago and what happened last year.
The problem was, while their sort of brutality backfired on them in 2011, nobody was held accountable for that. Tony Baloney lost 10 vacation days and otherwise was allowed to finish out his career a few years later and retire with a big fat pension. There was no accountability. Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance, never challenged the police on their conduct. So yeah, certainly when you had Black Lives Matter protests, explode, first in 2014 and then last year after the murder of George Floyd. Yes, the police, if anything, were, even more brutal, especially last year when obviously they felt threatened by what was happening. The situation in 2011 is they unintentionally allowed a lot of public sympathy. Mm-hmm. And awareness to boomerang back in favor of Occupy at some key moments when Occupy otherwise might have languished and never gotten as big as it did. Well, we're still waiting on our guest, and I apologize for that. Oh, good. I think we have Priscilla Grimm joining us here. Priscilla, are you there?
I am. Hello.
Hi. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So Priscilla was one of the editors of the Occupy Wall Street Journal during Occupy, a sister publication that we were good friends with, and has stayed involved with various Occupy-related formations. Since then. Just for starters, Priscilla, can you fill us in on what different Occupy groups and Occupy influence groups are doing around the 10th anniversary, which will kick off later this week?
Yeah, it's really exciting. People who are involved with the Occupy movement across the United States and maybe worldwide, I'm not sure if they'll be joining in the celebrations, but definitely in New York and Los Angeles, we're going to have events around our various anniversaries. And it's really just people gathering back at Zuccotti Park and, you know, back at the Stock Exchange to remind them that, you know, we're still here. And also just to, for the audience to understand, you know, a lot of the other Occupy Wall Street encampments that happened around the U.S., the encampments that were destroyed by the federal government, you know, they grew starting, at the end of September into mid-October and just kept going from there. So really what we're doing is we're going into a month of celebration to look back at a lot of the achievements that we've gotten. I mean, you know, Fight for 15 was kind of just a dream when Occupy Wall Street happened. And now over 74 jurisdictions, including cities, counties, and states, have all raised their minimum wages, many of them to $15 an hour or more at this point. So we have a lot of things to be thankful for. You know, changing both public opinion and the actual realities of what we, the people, can receive from our government in the sense of support has really drastically changed since 2011. It may not seem like a lot, but it's a lot more than we got 20 years prior. So really looking forward to meeting minds in the streets and talking about those achievements.
And talk a little bit more about what organizing grew from Occupy and what the organizers of Occupy have been doing in the past 10 years, you know, to garner that public support. It's not like it just happened during Occupy.
No, it didn't just happen. I mean, you have, so one, in the very virtual realm, you know, you had like some scrappy DIY media people who to this day still are delivering audiences on Facebook and Twitter. It's up to, it's almost 60 million people a year that we've been reaching for 10 years, which is quite a broad reach and quite a really powerful tool of engagement that is not, it's not censored or managed by nonprofit organizations or politicians. You know, these teams of which I work on, you know, we support their causes, certainly, but we're never going to be in a place where we say, no, world revolution is not necessary. We're never going to say, no, you know, capitalism can be friendly. No, it can't. It's destroying us. So that's like the very baseline. So building on that, you know, a year after Occupy Wall Street was squashed by the federal government, we had Occupy Sandy that sprung up in the wake of Hurricane Sandy, which, you know, much of the Rockaways and that coast of New York was completely destroyed. And while FEMA was handing out, you know, crackers and a phone and an ATM machine, like it was ridiculous. Occupy Sandy volunteers were helping people remediate mold out of their houses. They were helping people get fresh food, hot food delivered to them. They were surveying and canvassing the areas so they could find out who needed what, if they needed medication, doctors, whatever, childcare. They were doing that work. And out of that, you know, I think we see these super radical politicians now, especially in New York state and city, you know, we're looking at a place and a moment where we had the biggest rent protections, tenant protections ever in the past 20 or 30 years passed last year. Right. That wouldn't have happened without, you know, without the messaging and the activists of Occupy moving into these other realms. I mean, you know, certainly electoral involvement was not the goal at all of Occupy Wall Street, which was started largely by anarchists, but it is a happy coincidence that it happened out of it, right? So Yes.
I would say so. Can you sort of break it down a little bit more? I mean, so Occupy, you know, said we are the 99%, the 1% have rigged the system. And, you know, what was, can you talk, I guess, starting on the electoral side, I mean, would you say that was something that, that was amplified by the Bernie Sanders presidential campaigns? Is that where they kind of like took that message to the next level and then really introduced sort of a Occupy critique into mainstream politics and that other people have seized on?
I don't think Bernie would have gotten to the place that he did in his presidential run in 2016 without the support of Occupy Wall Street, honestly. Occupy Wall Street activists, not necessarily the movement, but, you know, and it helped, it changed the conversation completely, because before then you wouldn't have social media being as much of an influencing part to that discussion as you wouldn't have had that support for kitchen table conversations to maybe be more open to Bernie Sanders and his campaign and what he represented without this other narrative that was popping up and being able to be delivered into people's cell phones and in their browsers and emerging conversation over kitchen tables. So,
and while we've seen a lot of, you know, growth in public support of these ideas that we've just been speaking about, it's undeniable that the system that Occupy was confronting in a way has gotten worse.
Oh, yes.
So talk about that tension. I mean, there's more awareness, but capitalism feels more suffocating than ever.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know about the dying scream. The dying scream is the loudest one ever, right? And I would say, if anything, we're looking at a big dying scream of capitalism right now. And they're pulling out all the stops, aren't they? So
are you going to take the rest of us with them?
I certainly hope not. I really hope not. I mean, you know, you also have a huge network of mutual aid circles that have popped up in the past couple of years out of, you know, a need of the crisis. I mean, what was Occupy Sandy if not like a big mutual aid circle of thousands of people?
And so you see a connection from Occupy Sandy to the pandemic.
Oh, absolutely.
Emerged.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because, you know, when Occupy Sandy emerged, you had this big mutual aid effort that came out, but you really understand, you know, especially the activists who are part of it, it was not sustainable the way it was set up. But these smaller neighborhood-based mutual aid circles that are popping up all over the United States, not just in New York City, you know, are really providing possibilities in ways that we couldn't imagine even 5 years ago. So, I mean, you have mutual aid organizations like Equality for Flatbush, which has been delivering just immense resources to the communities in Flatbush, both groceries and non-perishable items that you need for your home. I mean, I don't know that the kind of support for something at that level would have been possible without, people's imaginations being opened up to what could be political involvement. It's the personal is the political again, right? And we have to help our neighbors before we even think about, you know, crushing these systems. We have to set up ways in which we can support each other before we start figuring out how to break these systems so that we can move forward. Because breaking systems is also going to make new needs emerge immediately. And we have to be ready to meet that if we're going to actually do this and figure out how to abolish policing and prisons, figure out how to move forward in an environmentally sustainable way.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. Yeah, mutual aid. That's a great point about it, you know, laying the groundwork for what happens next.
Speaking of
what happens next, what more groundwork do you think needs to be laid to see another uprising like Occupy?
I mean, Occupy, as big as it seemed, was still a very small portion of the population. You know, my daughter is 18 now, and she was 8 when it was happening, but she's 18 now. And you ask kids who are 18 about Occupy Wall Street, they have no idea that it happened, like none. Mm-hmm. Although they're doing way better. I don't know that their new that Gen Z's engagement with politics is quite amazing, and I'm in awe of it every day. But so there's obviously, you know, there are millions of people who have no idea that that even happened, but that's on the onus of all of us who were involved in that movement and want to see the possibilities of mutual aid, of moving forward out of a capitalist system. Like, you know, that's work that we have to do every single day, and making sure that there are different ways that people can plug in and connect in their own communities. I mean, you know, the Facebook page that I work on with other activists, we have an automatic response when people send messages into the page that says, we're all volunteer effort. You can't reach us personally. You know, we're just here when we're here. And what you should do is find those institutions, those organizations, those groups of people in your hometown who are doing the work of what you want to see in the next version of the world, and support them, give them life, put your efforts there.
Right. We're going to have to leave here in a minute, but do you want to let people know or ways they can either get in touch with some of these Occupy groups here in New York? And if there's anything happening at Zuccotti Park in the coming days that's worth people dropping
definitely
by for?
We have
about 30 seconds, then we have to go.
People's Puppets of Occupy Wall Street will be in the park this weekend. Everybody should show up to Zuccotti Park. And of course, Wall Street, the closing bell is at 4:00. So maybe show up around 2:00. We'll have some fun.
Okay. All right. Well, Priscilla Grimm from the Occupy Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
And come to Occupy Wallace T NYC. OccupyWallaceT.nyc is the website.
Okay. All right. Great. Once again, Priscilla Grimm, thank you so much for joining us this evening on WBAI Radio.
Thank you.
You bet. And we'll be back after this short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Amy Littlefield, who's been doing some great work on covering abortion rights and access. And we're going to hear from her on that crucial struggle. But first, this short break.
Again, looking at the mirror, making sure it's all the same. Has it been a year, making sure I understand that I'm looking here and the wizard where I am. Breathe, cheers to the long night sessions. Cheers to the time they turn to confessions. When you write your fears and hopes on the paper, music is the way I acknowledge the maker. Fortunately, it's my art. What you listen to is my heart. I probably lose heart cause I shed so much. I probably lose friends cause I care about my people more than cashing out stars. Peace to the ones on my side, there's my eagles. Peace to the ones bridging gaps of the people. No, my strength don't come from the evil. I seen shines from my heart, cause I am me. From the day I started to the day I departed, all that I want to be. I am me. From the day I started to the day I departed, all that I want to be. I am me. I ain't going nowhere. I ain't going nowhere. It's all that I want to be. I am me. I ain't going nowhere. I ain't going nowhere. It's all than a pot of gold, with it cause of heart and soul, with it in the end for the lessons I know, with it for the strength that I see I hold, with it in the eye, I see deeper than the eye, glitter in gold, not eye, wondering why, now I really understand why, music is still my life, yes it's the greatest, now I sing high on my greatness, all my kids in my praises, yes it's amazing, negativity is fading, positive anticipation, feeling like,
my joy comes in the morning.
That was I Am Me by Sampa the Great. I'm John Tarleton, and this is the Independent News Hour on WBAI Radio 99.5 FM, here with my colleague Amba Gagarian. And in a moment, we're going to turn to our second guest and talk about abortion rights and everything that's happening in Texas and why it actually also matters for people here in New York as well. But before we do that, Amba, I think we want to let people know about how they can support WBAI in this radio station and keep on bringing all these great voices on the air. We need people to give what they can. You can call 212-209-2950.
Yes, please give if you can. You can call 212-209-2950 or go online to give, the number 2WBAI.org, and every penny, dollar, $10, $1,000 helps. We all suffer from the idea that someone else is giving, but it may have to be you today. So again, the phone number is 212-209-2950, or you can go online to give, the number 2WBAI.org. We really appreciate it, and we appreciate your listenership.
Right, and when you give, you can make a generous one-time donation, or you can sign up to become a WBAI buddy for as little as $10 a month and become eligible for all sorts of great benefits that go with that membership. But most of all, you're helping keep this radio station on the air, a station that's its signal beams 100 miles in every direction from New York out to Long Island, up into the Hudson River Valley, over to New Jersey, and of course, all across the five boroughs. And this is a station that brings unique voices, the kind of voices you're not going to hear on other radio stations or television sets or pretty much anywhere else. And one of those voices we're going to hear from here in a moment is Amy Littlefield, that we're abortion access correspondent for The Nation, formerly a producer at Democracy Now!, a longtime friend of The Independent. She's been doing great coverage, in particular recently, of the terrible legislation that was approved in Texas called SB 8 that pretty much eliminates abortion protections for women in Texas, and creates a bizarre system of bounty hunters to enforce these new statutes that a number of other red states are looking to mimic, and the Supreme Court hasn't done anything to stop it. And so we're really excited to hear from Amy about the latest from Texas, but also the national implications of this and why people even here in a very liberal state like New York cannot rest easy. And Amy, thank you so much for joining us on 99.5 FM.
It's so great to be with you, John. And Amba, as you pointed out, this feels like home since I used to work as a producer at Democracy Now! I'm very familiar with that WBAI fundraising number. So it's great to be with you.
Yeah, well, we hope to make it a familiar number to everybody that's listening here on the station. So let's start with what's happening in Texas. Can you just quickly review why this is SB 8 is such a disastrous legislation, as
yeah.
well as the resistance that it's already facing, especially from people on the ground in Texas?
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think as you point out, Texas SB 8, this legislation that has gone into effect as of September 1st in Texas, is really giving us a preview of both what our country is going to look like when Roe v. Wade is overhauled and overturned by the Supreme Court, which is likely to happen imminently in the coming months and years, and also debuting what the, you know, fierce and furious resistance to these anti-abortion attacks looks like. So I can tell you, you know, I did some reporting on September 1st, which was the day that this law went into effect. And as you point out, the law bans abortion after fetal or embryonic cardiac activity is detected, which happens around 5 to 7 weeks of pregnancy, which is, you know, between 1 and 3 weeks after a missed period, right? So in the earliest stages of pregnancy. And allows any private citizen to basically enforce a $10,000 bounty onto, you know, anyone who violates this law by helping someone get access to an abortion. And what we've seen is basically a mass migration of patients outside of the state of Texas, which, you know, 1/10 of women of reproductive age live in the state. So, you know, the Guttmacher Institute has said basically Roe v. Wade is functionally meaningless for 1/10 of the, you know, women of reproductive age in this country. That's how big the state of Texas is. And this mass exodus from Texas is leading to huge waits, you know, waits of weeks in other neighboring states where people are having to go to abortion clinics. So, you know, I talked to a clinic in Oklahoma where last week they told me they were booked through the end of September. So you have this cascade effect where basically abortion access all through the South is, you know, backed up. And abortion is obviously a very time sensitive, you know, need, because it becomes riskier and more expensive the further along in a pregnancy you get. And so, you know, I've had, you know, I spoke with abortion funding organizations, which if you want to learn more about the grassroots activism going on around, abortion access in Texas, check out some of the abortion funds in the state, like the Lilith Fund, Jane's Due Process, which supports minors who are seeking access to abortion in Texas. And, you know, one of these activists with the Lilith Fund broke down and started crying on the phone with me on September 1st. She had been waiting up all night hoping that the Supreme Court was going to stop this law before it went into effect. And that didn't happen. And so what we've seen is really a human rights crisis, you know, where people who can afford to or who can secure, you know, the help of abortion funds are going as far afield as Seattle to get access to abortion care. And people who can't get that help or who can't, you know, figure out childcare or transportation or all of the very expensive, you know, layers of need that exist that stand between someone and abortion. In a situation like this, you know, those folks may be forced to remain pregnant against their will, or they may turn to, you know, this sort of robust underground network of extra legal medication abortion, which is, you know, alive and thriving in Texas. We have this sort of remarkable situation, and I wrote an article today for the New Republic about this, where, you know, Mexico's Supreme Court last week declared that in that country, abortion is no longer a crime. And you have these sort of informal pill distribution networks that exist between Mexico and Texas. And then you have this area, you know, this vast expanding array of options in terms of online access to medication abortion outside of our sort of legal system and outside of the reach of Texas law. And so many, many people, and we have no idea how many, are turning to those extra legal options as well, which, you know, potentially in some cases can incur legal risks for the people who are doing that. So that's sort of what things look like right now. And, you know, it is sort of a preview of the future in a lot of ways, but also I think, like, you know, abortion activists in the South would say they've been dealing with a crisis, not quite of this magnitude, but part of this sort of dire situation has been building in states like Texas for a long time.
And speaking of that, talk a little bit more about the inability for the surrounding states to actually handle any overflow when it comes to abortion clinics and backed up appointments.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen a drop in the number, especially of independent abortion clinics in recent years. A lot of those clinics have closed. You know, in Texas, about half of those clinics closed after the last round of restrictive legislation in 2013. And in surrounding states, too, it's very hard for independent abortion clinics to keep their doors open, given the, you know, raft of anti-choice restrictions we've seen that have made that harder and harder. So we have fewer clinics, which means that they're, you know, when you have one state that tries to choke off Texas access the way Texas has done, it creates this sort of cascade effect. And I think clinics and abortion funds and grassroots activists in states like New Mexico and Oklahoma have really been working hard to build up as much capacity as they can to handle these patients. But they're dealing with limited resources and with sort of series of successive cuts by anti-abortion legislators that have hindered those efforts.
Right. Now, the Republicans control, I think, something like 27 state governments in this country. And is it true that other states are looking to mimic Texas's legal strategy? Because I think the sort of the breakthrough the conservatives came up with in Texas with this bounty system, mm-hmm. which means that government officials are not enforcing their own law. It gives the courts a way of saying, well, we can't, sanction the government of Texas because there's no state official who's enforcing this law. And so it seems like conservatives have come with this, you know, bizarre workaround. And are other states looking to imitate this?
Oh, without a doubt. I think we've already seen Republican states say that they're going to take up legislation like this. I mean, I think at this point we're seeing, you know, anti-abortion state legislatures really throwing anything that sticks that they think might stick at the Supreme Court. This law was carefully designed by, you know, Jonathan Mitchell and his anti-abortion allies in the Texas state legislature and Texas Right to Life to withstand a court challenge, because Texas has tried before to shut down access to abortion and they've been unsuccessful because their efforts were transparently unconstitutional. And this law is also transparently unconstitutional, but as you point out, because of the way they wrote it, where it works through the civil litigation system, it was very hard to block before it came into effect. It was sort of designed to be court proof. And so without a doubt, I think we'll see other states now take this up with the goal of sort of ending access to abortion right now, you know, immediately. But the long game here is really to overturn Roe v. Wade and to allow states to ban and potentially criminalize abortion, you know, because we no longer have this, you know, half century old Supreme Court decision saying that they are not allowed to do that. And so that's been the long game. And we're seeing sort of the culmination of half a century of legal strategy by the Christian right aimed at overturning that precedent.
And in the run of this long game, where do more liberal liberal states like New York or California fall? Where do we fall when it comes to risk?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I mean, I think when people are looking for what to do, like a lot of the attention is on Texas right now, because that's where the emergency is right now. But it's important to focus on what's going on in our own backyards and what's going on with our, you know, local politics. I'm working on a story right now for The Nation about this. There are a lot of efforts to advance proactive legislation to expand abortion access. And that's happened successfully in states like Massachusetts, where I live, and in New York. So paying attention to, is your state legislature, you know, are there still laws on the books that, you know, from before Roe, or there's still laws on the books that, you know, prevent people from having abortions later in pregnancy, for example, and trying to repeal some of those measures and expand abortion access. Some of the most innovative efforts around that have had to do with public funding of abortion. So since 1976, we've had a federal policy called the Hyde Amendment in place, which bans federal funding of abortions, except in cases of rape or life endangerment of the pregnant person. And what that means is that Medicaid patients in most states don't have funding for abortion through their insurance. They have to pay for it. They have to raise hundreds of dollars for it out of pocket, which is prohibitive for most people. New York happens to be a state where, at least last I checked, Medicaid does cover abortion. And activists there with the New York Abortion Access Fund and their allies were able to get a measure passed to actually get public funding for abortion, for their efforts to, you know, fund abortion for people who still struggle to get access to care, even with the Medicaid policy in effect. And so, you know, I think paying attention to policies at the city and state level, is very important, especially because states, I mean, as we saw, you know, before Roe v. Wade, New York really was a destination state for people who would come from all over the country, and fly in to, if they had the means to seek legal abortion there. And so, I think activists in New York are gearing up for the possibility that that's going to happen again.
Right. And talk a little bit more about the long game here, because my sense is that the right to life people may be looking even beyond Roe versus Wade, because that's something they're on the cusp of achieving, especially now that Amy Coney Barrett became the ninth justice last year after the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And she's super conservative Catholic, almost the handmaiden justice. Right. But the longer game, could it be, I mean, I hear some chatter in right-wing circles that the next time they have full control of Congress and the White House, of trying to pass, you know, fetal protection laws that would criminalize abortion anywhere in the United States, essentially federalize it. Because I can't imagine them being like, okay, we prevailed in 30 Republican states, and we're just going to let abortion right. continue to happen in the rest of the country.
Right, right. I mean, and I think you'll hear, you know, Republicans talk about making this a state issue and letting states do what they need to do, you know, to ban abortion. And I think that is what we're likely to see in the near term, right? If Roe falls or is gutted beyond recognition, then about, you know, half of states are probably going to move to ban abortion. And, you know, we're going to see this sort of patchwork of access, which already exists, right? Care is already dependent on where you live in this country, and it's going to just deepen even more. I do think there are some strands of the anti-abortion movement that want to see fetal personhood, that want to see, you know, the fetus recognized as a unique human being with rights that are on par with, you know, the person carrying it. And, you know, one major question is, where does criminalization of the pregnant person and where does criminalization of anyone who helps someone get an abortion, where does that fit into that picture? Because self-managed abortion with pills is pretty readily available, even though a lot of people don't know about it. You know, at some point, if states are really intent on ending access to abortion, they're not going to really have an alternative besides going after people who are pregnant. And so that is sort of one theory about what the end game could look like. I think it's going to depend partly on how the reproductive health and justice movement responds to these threats and how politically unpalatable it seems to, you know, give rights to fetuses and to criminalize people who seek abortions.
Yeah, and in Republican America, only fetuses and corporations will have rights. The rest of us, not so much.
Yeah, it's a terrifying thought.
Also, just something I want to delve into a little bit. The sort of the deeper forces that are animating the anti-choice movement, and there's a lot of surface-level contradictions in what they do, because they're deeply opposed to birth control, mm-hmm. to any form of sex education except abstinence education. Mm-hmm. They're also opposed often to subsidized childcare, you know, social safety net measures that would make it easier for women and families to raise the children
right.
They give birth to.
Right.
What's this sort of the going on here with this sort of this patriarchal Christian right-wing forces, mm-hmm. and you know, what do you think drives this? Because it certainly doesn't seem to be concern for human life, given how they act the rest of the time.
Right, right. Absolutely. I mean, I think we're sort of past the point where we should be talking about like hypocrisy, right? As if, you know, Republicans only care about abortion and, you know, this is just a glitch in the system that they forgot about birth control or something. I mean, I think we have to zoom out and the whole project makes sense if you understand that it was never about the sanctity of life, right? It was always about controlling women's place in society. It was always about sort of this worldview of the white nuclear family, you know, heterosexual nuclear family, and opposing birth control has always been part of that project. And I think the way we're seeing it emerging is, you know, conflating things like IUDs and, you know, emergency contraception with abortion, right? Like twisting the science to somehow claim that contraception is abortion. And, you know, opposing the rights of LGBTQ people and trans people, and all of the state legislation that we're seeing attacking the rights of trans people is all part of this project as well, because, you know, trans people don't exist in this, you know, landscape that the Christian right is imagining. It's about sort of the power of wealthy white you know, cis men. And I think it's important to look at the fact that white supremacy has been part of the anti-abortion movement for as long as it's existed, right? Like, it's no coincidence that we see people wearing, you know, Make America Great Again hats who were in Washington, D.C. for the March for Life, like, you know, having run-ins with people of color outside, you know, in the state capitol. It's no coincidence that when we look at who was participating in the January 6th riot at the Capitol, we see a lot of popular, recognizable anti-abortion extremists who have, you know, been harassing people outside of abortion clinics or even firebombing them. You know, there are deep connections between, you know, racism, misogyny, and the anti-abortion movement in this country that are like not counterintuitive. It's kind of part of the wider project.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. But Amy Littlefield, the abortion access correspondent for The Nation, thank you so much for joining us this evening on WBAI.
Thanks, John.
You bet. All right, well, so we're going to have to wrap up our show for tonight here in a sec. I want to thank my co-host, Amma Gagarian. Also, Nancy Hoke helped us with headlines. And we've had Reggie Johnson, our board operator, as always, a stalwart, helping us. And once again, that phone number you can call to give, that phone number that Amy Littlefield knows so well, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, or give number two, WBAI.org. We'll be preempted next week, but we'll be back in 2 weeks at the same time. And we'll catch you then.
Uppers had in common, these were people who were unable to sit out a historic cataclysm.
And if you look at footage from United in Anger of a Monday night meeting where there'd be 300 to 700 people at the Gay Center, you can see that it's mostly white gay men. But when you look at the work that people did, when they left that Monday night meeting, people were working in coalition with all kinds of communities and all kinds of organizations. There were people working with drug users and fighting for needle exchange, and there were people fighting for housing for homeless people. There were people working for incarcerated people with HIV. There were people working with mothers who were HIV positive.
Tune to Out FM from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday, September 14th. For a two-hour fundraising special on the history of the direct action AIDS group, ACT UP, on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Mother Earth is occupied by the United States of Amazon. Call it surveillance capitalism. Sunday, September 19th in New York. Mother Earth is occupied by the United States of Amazon. Call it surveillance capitalism. Sunday, September 19th in New York City. Come together for peaceful conversation on how to create a better tomorrow. Connect the dots from Assange to Mumia, COVID and climate, housing and policing, from Afghanistan to Yemen. We're building coalitions. Black Lives Matter and Code Pink to Extinction Rebellion and Veterans for Peace, WBAI, Pacifica Radio, and more. Join us Sunday, September 19th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in Foley Square. I'm Zul, and I'm a whistleblower for justice, people, and planet. Rising Together, that info for more information.
The previous program